Good evening. My name is Robert, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'd like to thank my friend Bob for inviting me to come out here and share with you this evening. I met Bob a few years ago, and he's a heck of a guy. He's a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm always very, very impressed with him. I mean, even today, after he picked me up at the airport, we rushed from the airport and went to the detox center, and here's a guy with a lot of time. He's in the middle of the day, he's sharing there. You know, to me, he's a great example. I'd love to be like him when I grow up. You know, I'd like to thank Rick and Rich for their hospitality. Those guys fed us very well today. I'm absolutely stuffed. I could take a little nappy poo right about now. But, you know, and I noticed we have a lot of newcomers here tonight, you know, and I love newcomers. I got to tell you, whether you know it or not, you're very, very lucky to be here tonight. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that's ever happened to me. You know, I didn't know that in the beginning. Also, if you're new, I just want to talk to you just for a second, because if you're anything like I was when I was new, my attention span was about that long, so I couldn't listen to the speaker very long. But the way this thing has worked for me, it's very important for me to show up to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, don't drink between meetings, and for me, it was to become willing to do what was asked of me to do. And most important, for a guy like me, who liked to do his own thinking, it was important for me to get a sponsor. You see, with that sponsor helped me to get out of the backseat of that car that I was living in. I didn't know how to get out of there. I thought I did, but I didn't know how to get out of there. So those are the key ingredients. And again, this program takes patience. You know, nothing happens overnight. You see, I didn't end up sleeping in the back seat of that car. One night, I just ended up sleeping there. You know, it didn't happen that way. You know, all of a sudden, the next thing I know, that's where I am. Well, it's the same way in sobriety. It takes a little while, you know, just day by day. Things tend to get a little better and a little better. And for me, a guy like me, I'm glad things didn't get better overnight, because I wouldn't be here tonight if that happened for me. You know, years ago I had been to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I just didn't think it would work for me. But I knew that I needed to stop drinking. And I had heard about this man that was over on 51st and Normandy in Los Angeles. And they said that this guy was a healer. You know, no matter what disease you had, you know, he could heal you of this. So I thought, well, I think I'll just mosey over there, you know. So that night, I went over there to that little church they had on 51st and Norman, and there he was. He was standing up at the podium. He was preaching, and, you know, the members were out there. And I went there to get healed from my alcoholism, you know. But what he did, there was a young man in a wheelchair. He decided to take this young man first, you know. He says, well, he prayed for this young man. They prayed for him. And what he said to us, he says, with everybody's cooperation here in the congregation, this young man will walk tomorrow. I thought, wow, you know, if he can do that for his kid, he's sure going to cure my alcoholism. You know, say, but what we need to do, we all need to fast for the next 24 hours, and we need to pray for this young man. If we all do that, I guarantee you this young man will rise from that wheelchair and he will walk across the floor. I thought, all right. You know, so I left that church that night, and I thought about that young man, and I said a prayer. I prayed for him, and I prayed for him, you know, and I looked at my watch, and it was 12 o'clock, you know, and I really wanted to see a young man walk, you know, and I went on about my business. I started praying for him again, you know, praying for him again. And I looked at my watch, and it's 1:30, and I continued to pray for him. Next time I looked at my watch, it was 1:45. You know, them stores close at 2. I looked at my watch, it was 1:45. I say, this boy ain't going to walk because I'm drinking. So I don't know if he walked or not. But my point to the story is that it does take patience. A person like me can't do it the easiest soft way. Even a healer wouldn't work for me. You know, also, if you're new, I am no expert on this. I'm basically going to tell you about me, what it was like for me, what happened, and what it's like for me today. You know, like I said, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Absolutely love it. I come from a good home. I was born and raised in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, you know, which is no reason to drink. That's just where I'm from, you know. I had great parents. My parents were married for over 50 years. I had three brothers and two sisters. I was taught right from wrong. I went to church every Sunday. In fact, I went to church three or four times a week. I swore when I became an adult I wouldn't go to church. It was another reason so difficult for me to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had related it to church, you know. But and my father spent a lot of time with his boys, you know. I'll never forget the first time I heard the word alcoholic or what a drunk was there was a man in my neighborhood. His name was Mr. Stanley. And Mr. Stanley was always drunk. Mr. Stanley was very smelly, very, very dirty, and he couldn't speak well. You know, my father would point to Mr. Stanley and say, "Now, boys, Mr. Stanley is an alcoholic," he'd say. "Mr. Stanley cannot help himself. That's what whiskey does for you," is what my father would say. And my father would also say, my father's one of them good old Southern Baptists, he would also say, "It's a sin to drink whiskey," is what he would say. You know, in fact, as I remember it, it seemed to me that everything that was really fun to do, it was a sin to do it, you know. You know, growing up, you know, I love the blues. I love the blues, you know, and I'll never forget my mother said, you know, they call the blues sinning music is what they call it. You know, and I remember I was quite young, and I looked up at my mother, and I said, "You mean if I sing those blues, I'm going to go to hell?" She said, "That's right." I said, "Well, I just have to go to hell because I yike them blues," you know. But it just seemed like everything was a sin to do it. And my father, he strongly suggested we don't drink, so I didn't drink at a young age. I went through school. I participated in sports. I love sports. I played everything, basketball, football, baseball. I ran track. And I was also told that athletes don't drink and they don't smoke. So I didn't drink it. I didn't smoke. I remember every Friday we would have a dance at the school, and the guys would try to get me to drink, and I wouldn't. I was more afraid of my dad than anything. I didn't want to go home with booze on my breath, you know. But I wouldn't drink it. I remember, I'll never forget the last dance we were having my senior year. You know, the guy said, "Come on, Rob, you haven't had a drink with us. You know, a lot of us are going to go off to the military. You know, some are going to go away to college. So come on, have this drink, have this last blast with us," you know. I'll never forget when they handed me that bottle of wine. I just started chugging it down. And I'll never forget. I felt so good. I felt so good. I walked into that gym and that music was sounding so good. And I just had no control over my body, and I was shaking, I was dancing, slid across the floor to what I thought was the prettiest girl in there and asked if she wanted to dance, and she said, "Yeah," and I'm just having such a good time and running around the gym, just rapping to all the ladies in there, and I thought, damn, no wonder Dad don't want me drinking this stuff, you know. It was working really well for me, you know, but I didn't shoot off and become an alcoholic behind that. I ended up going to college on a baseball scholarship. And I would go and I'd play baseball. As soon as baseball season was over with, I'd drop out of school and I'd move to Chicago, you know, and start working there. And during that time, they were drafting young men into the military, you know. So I'd move to Chicago and I'd start working. I'd get a letter from the draft board and they say, "Well, Robert, what are you doing?" I'd rush back to Arkansas and enroll in school and say, "Well, I'm in school," you know. And I'd stayed out of the military. I played that game for about 4 years and finally got drafted into the military. And ended up going, getting sent to a war that I didn't want to be there, but I had to go. And I'll never forget when I got there. Somehow I found the Airman's Club, and I started drinking. I am so grateful to alcohol for that, you see, because I was really fearful. I thought for sure I was going to get killed over there, you know, but I was very fortunate. You know, but I found the Airman's Club, and I started drinking. And for me, drinking removed that fear that I had. You know, alcohol always made me a happy person and make me act like, you know, that person that I'm not. It removed that fear. And I was able to get through that. You know, so I did my tour of duty over there, and I ended up coming back to the States. And by this time, I already have a wife and I have a son, you know. So I wanted to go back and finish school, but I couldn't afford to do that because I had to support my family. And when I got back to the States, I had an older brother. My oldest brother was a member of the Los Angeles Police Department, and he says to me, "They're hiring, you know, in the police department. Why don't you give it a shot?" You know, so I says, "Okay, what the heck," you know. So I did. During that time, the police academy was 20 weeks of intense training. You know, I'm out of the military, and I go and I apply for the police department. I get accepted, and I go to the academy, you know. And here it is, 20 weeks later, I meet the police. I thought, this is great. I'm the man. You know, if the boys back home in Arkansas could see me now, you know. And a lot of times, you know, when I tell people that I worked as a police officer, you know, one of the first questions they ask me is, well, did you shoot anybody? You know, and no, I never shot anybody, but I came close one time. I'd like to share with you what happened on that occasion. I think I had about 5 or 7 years on this job as a police officer, and I had started drinking a lot. It was as simple as that. I was drinking an awful lot. My nerves were shot, you know, and I remember it was on a Sunday morning, and generally on a Sunday day watch, this division that I was working, it's not a lot of activity on Sundays, so it's cool. I show up to work, we go to roll call, and they give us this information on a robbery suspect. You know, they give us a great description of the guy, give us a vehicle description of the guy, you know, and where he lives. You know, and it turns out this guy was lives in my area, you know, but I felt that I was pretty lucky that day because, you see, they had assigned me to work with a rookie. So if I'm working with a rookie, I'm the training officer. I decided I'm going to be the wheel man today. Let him be the book man. See, if I'm the wheel man, we are going to drive down all these streets where there's absolutely no activity, so we're not about to do any police work, you know. So we got all this information on a robbery suspect, and we go out and we check out the police car. And this kid looks over at me, and he goes, hey, Cookie. I go, yeah. He goes, let's go scoop him up. I goes, who? He says, a robbery suspect. He's in our area. This alcoholic brain of mine starts turning, and I think, okay, this guy knows that we know who he is. He knows that we know where he lives. He knows we know what kind of vehicle he drives. He's not going to be there. I said, great idea, kid. Let's roll over, you know. So we go to the location, and I get on the radio, and I request about 8 black and white units to meet me at that location. So all these units come screaming in there. And here I am, I'm telling these 2 guys, you 2 guys go around the back, you 2 guys take this side, and Sarge, you come with me. And I think they're thinking, look at old Cookie doing this police work. You know, so we go up to the door, and we knock on the door. Boom, 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 boom. And a voice from behind the door goes, who is it? We go, stop, police, open up. And the guy goes, well, wait a minute, my wife don't have any clothes on, you know, so we think we'll give it a couple of minutes, you know. So then we think, we'd better go in here. So we do, we kick the door in, boom. We run in here, and these officers are running around this apartment. They're looking for this guy. And I was standing at the front door, and I thought, well, perhaps I should be looking too, you know. So what I saw one of the officers come out of the bathroom. And I thought, now there's a safe place for me to go and look, you know. So I walked into the bathroom as if I was looking. But in the bathroom, there was a shower curtain there. It was pulled back all but about that much. And something told me to look behind that bath. The shower curtain, and I pull that shower curtain back, and there he was. He scared me so bad, I grabbed my gun, I put it in his face, I said, freeze. I said, get out of that tub. And every time he got ready to get out, I go, don't you move. You know, I say, let me have some ID, give me some ID. And he didn't have no ID, he didn't have no clothes on, you know. But that's as close as I came to shooting somebody. But I tell you, I worked that job, and I absolutely loved that job. I would get out from work in the evening, and I wanted to go back until my drinking, you see, my drinking took over. I had no idea that there was anything wrong with my drinking. I know that what I had started doing, I had started taking time off from work. You see, they gave us 12 sick days a year, and I would take all that time off from work, you know, and I was drinking a lot. You know, and I had no idea there was anything wrong with my drinking. And what happened to me, I ended up showing up to work once on day watch. And they looked at me and they said, well, Robert, we think you've been drinking. And I says, no, I have not been drinking. I don't drink on duty and I don't drink before I come to work. I drink at night. What I do at night is my business. They said, well, we think you've been drinking. So what they did that day in that police station in full uniform, I had to blow in that breathalyzer. I'll never, ever forget blowing a .23, you know. And they looked at me, and they looked at the machine, and then they look at me. Then they start calling other officers over. Hey, come here. They say, look at this. And look at him. And I was proud of that, really, you know. yeah, I blew that, you know. And I thought, you know, because I could blow a .23 on that machine, and I could go out on the streets and administer the field sobriety test to you, no problem, you know. But that day they decided it wasn't safe for me to go on the streets. You know, so what they did, they sent me over in the detective bureau, and I had to work over there for the whole day. And in the detective bureau, they have a huge pin map of the area that you work. And it's, they have these little red, yellow, green, blue pins, and if it's a burglary, robbery, a person, no matter what it is, a car, it had to put these pins on the specific corner that the crime occurred. That's how they could tell the pattern of the crime. Now, if you're a guy that's been out drinking all night, you know, when you come in that day and you haven't had anything for 4 or 5 hours, it's kind of difficult to take them little pins and hit them little streets, you know. And I was just, I'd take two hands and zero in there and finally get one or two in. And they sit there in amusement for a while and they told me, why don't I go home? They ordered me not to drink. You know, and I remember going home and I remember not drinking that day. And about a week later, I showed up to work and they told me the captain wanted to see me in the office. You know, and I didn't want to go into that captain's office because you only go in there for two reasons. Either you're going to get accommodation or you're in trouble. And I hadn't done anything in years to get accommodation for, you know. So I went in that captain's office, and what he handed me were the 20 questions that you see around here in Alcoholics Anonymous. He told me to answer those questions and answer those as honestly as I could. You know, and I sat down there and I took that test and handed it back to him, and he read that. And what the guy said to me, looked at me, he says, well, Robert, the way you answer these questions, you are an alcoholic. And my first thought was, well, who wrote this? You know, who are they to say I'm an alcoholic? I didn't say that to the captain, you know, but I thought it, you know. He called me an alcoholic, and I'm thinking, alcoholic? I am nothing like Mr. Stanley. I'm clean. I might be a little smelly, but I'm clean. You know, I'm at work. I have a car out there. I'm not laying out in a ditch. I am not like Mr. Stanley. Again, that's what I thought. I didn't say that. You know, but the man said to me, Robert, I would suggest that you go to AA. He said, they have an AA meeting downtown that's for all law enforcement officers. You know, I have no idea where I had been all that time, but I really, really did not know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anybody that was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous or anything. I had seen on TV and movies, you know, I thought it was just Hollywood, you know. But he told me I was going to go to an AA meeting. I said, sure, you know, all right. You know, so I went to a meeting on a Thursday night downtown LA in the basement of a church. And there were about 20 or 25 other police officers down there, some of which I knew, some I didn't know. And they were all smiles, and they were very happy to see me, they said. We're glad to see you, Robert. We've been waiting for you. Thinking, what do they mean, you know? And they had nerve enough to offer me. I didn't even drink coffee, you know. Can you imagine a cop don't drink coffee? I didn't even drink coffee, you know, and they handed me a half cup of coffee, you know, and I said thank you with a little fake smile, you know, and I sat there in that meeting, and a woman came up, and she started talking about her day and what she felt. And man, you know, I could really identify with her. I understood that because I had felt that way myself. But the thing that turned me off about that woman, she says, but I didn't take a drink. And I thought, you didn't take a drink? Oh, no. I'm thinking, no drinking? You see, I thought they were sending me to the AA meeting so they would tell me what situations I drink in and which ones I don't. You know, I didn't know they were talking about no more drinking, you know. So I ended up, I ended up going to that meeting until I thought the heat was off, and I stopped going to that meeting, and I started drinking again. I ended up coming back to work, and ended up putting me on the breathalyzer again, and this time they suspended me for 10 days. And I'll never forget, I felt mistreated that they suspended me from this job for 10 days. And I thought, well, I got to figure out a way to get them back, you know. So I was off for 10 days, shaking my fists at them, drinking every day, very angry at them, you know. And when I went back to work that first day, I'll never forget, I ended up finishing the full day, the first day back. And I went out and played basketball that evening off duty, and I twisted my ankle. So I said, that's the ticket, you know. So I called the next day and said, I twisted my ankle while I was on duty the day before so that I could be off on injury on duty. So they put me off injury on duty. But during that time, the police department could pay a sick visit to you. They could come and check you out, see how you're doing, you know. So what I would do, I was ready for them. You know, I'd see this black and white pulling up to my home. So I'd jump up and I grab two ace bandages. And I wrap these ace bandages around my ankle and put a sock over the ace bandage so the ankle was looking like that. You know, and when they come in, I'd sit in this recliner, and I'd put the bad ankle up in the air so they could see it really good, you know, and I'd have a crutch on the wall, you know, and they'd say, well, Robert, how are you doing? I go, not very well. They just may have to cut on this ankle. And the guy looked at me and says, well, Robert, I don't know who you think you're fooling. The last time we were in here, you had the other ankle up. You know? But what those two men did for me, it was a captain and a lieutenant. Those two men sat in my living room. They talked to me. That captain said to me, Robert, I understand how you feel. He says, I understand that you have to drink. As far as I know, neither of those men were alcoholic. At that time, I realized that I had to drink. You see, for a long time, I drank alcohol, and I thought I was drinking it because I wanted to drink it. But you see, I had come to the point I had to drink booze. No matter what, I had to drink. The man said, I understand that. So he says, what we're going to do for you, there's an excellent recovery place down in Orange County. I'm going to take you down there, and we're going to cover for you. Those two men took me down to Orange County and got me admitted into an alcohol rehab center. And during that time, the insurance companies were not paying for that, so they said something else was wrong with me. But those guys, they covered for me, and I'll never forget when I had to sign those documents to sign in. You know, my hand shook so bad until I really couldn't sign my name. You know, and I just gave a little smile and looked at the captain and said, I'm just a little nervous about coming here, you know. But I stayed in that program for 21 days. And I'll tell you, when I left that program, I looked better, I acted better, and I certainly smelt better, you see. But what happened for me, after 21 days, it was on a Sunday afternoon. I remember inviting my girlfriend down. I remember inviting my family to come down because from that program, we had a big graduation. It was about 20 of us graduating. And you know, I took that literally. When they gave me that little diploma with the little ribbon wrapped around it, I have graduated from AA. But what they did tell me that I would have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. They did tell me that I'd have to work the steps. They said you have to get a sponsor. You have to call people. They said all that. I ignored that. I left that place. I went back to work. And my arrests came up, my tickets came up, and everything. I was doing very well. But for 90 days, I didn't drink alcohol. I didn't drink alcohol for 90 days. I got to tell you, my life, for me, it actually got worse. For me, it did. But you see, I didn't go to AA meetings. I never talked to another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 90 days. And one beautiful day on a Sunday afternoon, never ever forget it, my car is washed, it's clean. I'm dressed. The thought occurred to me, hey, Robert, you can't drink no more for the rest of your life. And that thought was a little bit too overwhelming for me. I pulled into a liquor store, and I bought a pint of booze, a pint of gin. I'll never forget that. And I remembered, you said, talk about this with somebody before you did. You talk to somebody. So I got a lot of voices up here. So we start talking, going back and forth, talking. And we all came to the same conclusion. I should drink. And I did. I ended up drinking for another year and a half straight. Going to work, not going to work. And finally, one day, they put me on that breathalyzer again. Finally, what they did, they sent me downtown. That was heavy when they send you downtown. That's called a trial board. You know, prior to that, I had filed for my pension from the city. That's a trial board. You go downtown, and you got to sit before these guys down there, and they're going to decide your fate. So they sent me down there, you know, and I knew it was all over for me, and it was. It was on a Friday, November the 13th, 1981. Those men said to me, you are a liability to the city, and we recommend termination, you know, and I was crushed. I had no idea what I was going to do. That was the only thing I knew to do was to be a police officer. You know, and I left from downtown. I stopped at the first liquor store, and I bought me some booze, and I drank and I cried. I had no idea what I was going to do, you know. And I thought, a very smart thought finally came to me and said, Robert, I know the problem. What? The problem is L.A. You need to get out of L.A. And I thought, yeah. You know, I did. I left L.A., it was 11 p.m. on a Friday, And I arrived in Pine Bluff, Arkansas on a Tuesday morning at 9:30. I took the Greyhound bus. I will never take the Greyhound bus from California to Arkansas again. That was the longest ride. I went down there with my parents, moved in with my parents, and nothing changed. Nothing changed. I started drinking, doing the same thing, and I finally ended up coming back to L.A. And I was just very lucky. I feel very, very blessed. I ran across a friend of my cousin who was a veteran, and he told me, he said, "You're a veteran, aren't you?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "They have an excellent program at the VA hospital." And I thought, the VA hospital, man, it's just a bunch of drones out there. I don't want to go out there, you know. Here's a guy at this point in my life, I had no place to live. I was sleeping in the back seat of a car that the finance company was looking for. I didn't even want to live, you know. But he said, "You can go to the VA, you know." So I ended up going to the VA. I'll never forget that. I went to that VA hospital on that Friday. And I remember them talking to me, to ask me some questions, you know. And he told me, he said, "You're going to have to act a little crazy so they'll take you." I said, "No problem," you know. So I went up there and I started talking to this woman. And the next thing I knew, I was dead serious. I was dead serious. I started pounding on that desk and I started crying. I mean, tears were streaming down my face. I says, "You got to help me. I can't stop drinking. I don't want to drink, but I can't stop." That woman's eyes got big. She looked at me and she said, "You come with me." You know, they took me in the back and I talked with the doctor. They gave me a shot of B12 and they told me, during that time in 1983, in January of 83, it was raining every day. And during that time, there was a lot of veterans trying to get into the VA hospital. In fact, they had a waiting list for like 3 to 4 weeks for you to get in there. But I was very lucky. They told me to come back that Monday morning and they would admit me into the alcohol ward. And you know, the amazing thing for me and the reason why I know I have a higher power is because that Monday morning, I returned to the VA hospital. You see, I'm the type of guy, I would have walked away from that hospital on that Friday, and I would have said, "Things are not quite that bad. I just need a job, you know." But I went back to that hospital, and that's when my recovery began. I was very blessed that I was able to start hearing. That was just one thing that was important to me. I would listen to you talk about what happened to you, and I was able to believe a little bit, maybe that did happen to you, but I would also think, it's different for me. I am different than you. You don't know how I feel. You don't know how I feel. You see, I judge the way you look with the way that I felt. To me, you look good. You look clean. Your eyes are clear. I don't feel like that. I'm the type of guy that drinks that hot vodka from underneath his car seat right out of the bottle. I can't quit drinking. I've just lost my family. I don't have a job. I don't have any place to live. I want to quit drinking, but I can't quit drinking. How do you know how I feel? You don't know how I feel. But for some reason, I stayed here, and I kept going to meetings. And you know, one day, I woke up, and I didn't have a desire to drink alcohol. That was one of the biggest things for me, to wake up and not have a desire to drink alcohol. Because you see, every day my eyes came open, I had to drink. You see, and that one day, I didn't have to drink alcohol. I completed that program after about 5 weeks, and they said, "It's time for you to go out." I said, "I don't want to leave here because I cannot stay sober." This happened to me before, I said. The guy says to me, "If you go to AA, you will be all right." He said, "You go to a meeting every night and you get yourself a sponsor." He said, "This program works." I didn't believe him, but I said, "I'm going to go to a meeting every night. I'm going to go to a meeting every night. I'm going to show this guy that this thing does not work." You know, so I did. I started going to meetings. That's how I ran across the home group I'm in. I didn't know they had meetings all over the place, but I ran across this home group, and these people were just very, very nice to me. You know, they extended their hand. They shook my hand, you know. Here's a guy who came to them homeless. Not one person in there asked me, "Where did I come from?" Not one person asked me, "What was I doing there?" What the people said to me is that I was welcome. And they made me feel welcome there. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going to those meetings. They said, "You got to get yourself a sponsor." Man, I didn't have any idea what a sponsor was. I'd heard that word for weeks, a sponsor. You know, I thought it was something like trying to get Coca-Cola to sponsor you or something, you know. But I finally, one of the guys who had a couple of months more than me, he said, you get my sponsor, it's Julian, you know. So I got Julian to sponsor me. And for some reason, Julian reminded me of my father, you know. Julian says to me, you know, he was a no-nonsense guy. Julian says to me, I want you to go to 7 meetings a week, get 7 commitments, go to the yard on Saturdays, and do what the winners do. I said, okay. So I did. I started going to these meetings. After a while, now I got 90 days. I'm getting a little cocky. I'm feeling good, you know. And a friend of mine had about 90 days, and his sponsor had given him a day off. I go, a day off, huh? So I go to my sponsor and say, Julian, I need a day off. He says, a day off. He say, what are you going to do with it? I couldn't answer that question. So he say, yeah, I want a day off. You can have a day off. Gets up another sponsor. Oops. And they use the word firing. You know, my sponsor fired me. And I've always had, that's been a bad sound for me. You know, I didn't want to get fired. You know, so I didn't take a day off. You know, and Julian also asked me, he says, you work? I lied. I said, no, I don't have to work. You know, I'm retired. He says, well, we work in this group. We work around here. He says, what'd you do when you work? I said real smug, I was a police. You know, he goes, okay, go over there and ask Frank for a job. He's got a security firm. I looked at him, security, you know. So I went over and asked Frank for a job. Frank gave me a job, and I suited up in my security outfit. I shined my shoes. I was very clean, and I went to that job very alert. I got to tell you, that job paid me $4.50 an hour. I never, ever forget it. That job paid me $4.50 an hour. It's been the best job I've ever had in my life. I worked that job. I showed up. I felt good about who I was and what I was doing. I'd go to those meetings. I'd shake hands. I'd smile, and I'd have a good time. I felt good about who I was. I loved not drinking. I loved having the bright eyes. You know, when I was about 9 months sober, I got a call from my attorney. My attorney told me the city's been ordered to rehabilitate you. What is it you want to be when you grow up? You know, I thought, this is great. You know, what I had always wanted to do, I'd always wanted to go into the computer industry. But I would never tell anybody that because I was afraid you might say, well, why don't you do it? You know. So I took this information to my sponsor. I told him about the opportunity that had come up. And he asked me the same questions. What do you want to do? And I told him. So he says, well, why don't you try? You see, again, I'm the type of guy, if I don't think I can do it, I won't even try. I will not even try if I don't think I can do it. So I got the sponsor direction to try it, and I did. I found a school, electronic school, and I went to that school. I ended up completing that class. People in Alcoholics Anonymous helped me with that because I had all these years, I thought I was a bad student. You know, I thought I couldn't learn. But what I found out is that I'm just not organized, and I just wasn't willing to put the work in. And people in Alcoholics Anonymous took time off with me after the meetings and helped me to get organized, helped me to study. And I was able to complete that class. I graduated in the top 10% of my class. I was able to go out and find the job. You know, the first job I found, I'll never forget, I showed up in this guy's office for an interview. I passed a written test, showed up for the interview, and I really didn't want to talk to this guy. I just knew I wasn't going to get hired because I don't know anything about electronics, you know. I've only been in this school for 10 months. So I just showed up like my sponsor said, and the guy said, well, Robert, tell me a little bit about yourself. So I started telling him about this little school I had gone on, the hands-on training I had, and I noticed on this guy's wall he has some plaques, some golf plaques and trophies, so I figured the guy must play golf. I say, and my hobby is playing golf. So we talked about golf for a while. I got the job, you know. And I worked that job for 5.5 years, and another chance came along, and I talked to my sponsor about it. And he told me to try that, and I did. This company was a good company, working on computers. I loved it. It was a great, I got a chance to travel a lot, you know. And I'll tell you, when I was a kid growing up, I used to watch TV, you know, and Jim would have his business suit on, and he'd have his briefcase, and Jim was a businessman. And old Jim had been out of town on business, and that just always had a good ring to it to me. You know, I loved that. You know, and sure enough, my first time I got sent away to Boston for 3 weeks, you know, for training. And when I went to Boston, I'll never forget, I flew in and they put us up in a very nice hotel. And all of a sudden, I started feeling very lonely and very alone. You know, I'm so far away from home and don't know anybody. I started thumbing through the material that was on the desk in my room, and they had a list of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I called that phone number, and they told me where AA was. They said, "Can you get here? You need someone to pick up." I said, "No, I got wheels. You just tell me how to get there." So they told me how to get there. And I went to that meeting, and again, I walked in there, and again, I started feeling not a part of, you see, because this is a bunch of strange alcoholics, you know, I don't know these. And it occurred to me, just do what you've been doing at home, you know, so I just started extending my hands, shaking hands. I call it working the room, and I worked that entire room. "Hi, my name is Robert. I'm visiting here from Los Angeles." You know, and I'll tell you something, there was a guy in there, reached into his pocket with his business card and wrote his home phone number on there, and he gave me that. He says, "Robert, you call me anytime. You see, I don't know any other place or any other organization you can show up and they never laid eyes on you, and they'll give you their home phone number. Just an Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only place I know." That man gave me his phone number, and I got through that really well. I had my own meetings I went to there. After my 3 weeks were over, I came back home, and I'm walking around in my home group, and my friends are saying, "Robert, we've missed you. Where have you been?" I said, "I've been out of town on business, you know." Alcoholics Anonymous has been fantastic for me. I don't stand here and tell you all good happened, because it's not all good. Basically, the only thing you promised me when I got here is sobriety. You didn't promise me a wife. You didn't promise me a job. You didn't promise me a car. You promised me sobriety. If I work the steps and I do what my sponsor tell me, you told me my life would get better. And it did, and it has. When I got here, I owed a lot of money to the IRS and the State Franchise Tax Board. They were sending me letters and letters and letters. I was not opening those letters. I knew it wasn't no refund in there, you know. But I made the mistake of telling my sponsor about it, and I had to take care of that, you know. And I did. I paid off all my taxes. You know, I have gotten married in sobriety, and I have gotten divorced in sobriety. I have had death in my family. I lost my mother in 1997 to cancer. And then the biggest loss to me was in 2001. It was my brother Benny. You see, when I was in Vietnam, my brother Benny is the same brother that when I grew up as a boy, we used to sleep in the same bed together. Benny was my favorite brother. I had three brothers. I loved my brother Benny. He's the one that came to Vietnam so that I could leave Vietnam. Benny and I talked on the phone every single day. You know, I knew Benny was a little sick, but I never had any idea how sick he was. And he ended up going to the hospital, and he never came out of the hospital. You see, and that was a big loss to me. And when we had Benny's funeral, members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to, they had never met him before, but they came to his funeral to support me. Members of AA called me every day, came over to my home. Guys I sponsor called me every day, said, "What can I do for you? Is there anything I can do for you?" And I just kept going to meetings, going to meetings, going to meetings, you know, and I got through that. I still miss Benny until this day. But you see, you can get through that without drinking. I got through that without drinking. That was a big loss to me, you know. My boy, I have a son that's got this disease, and I watched him come into AA. I watched him get sober, and I watched him walk out the doors. And I'll never forget my son. He lived in Lancaster. I was very worried about him, you know, so I thought I'd go up and visit with him. And my son, when he's healthy, he's 6'2", and he weighs about 240 pounds. I went up to visit my son, and my son was still 6'2", but he weighed about 150 pounds. He could barely walk. He's very pale, and it just didn't look like my boy. I couldn't handle it. He was so bad off. He knows that I don't drink. He was so bad off, he asked me if I would buy him a drink. But you see, I've been there before, too. I remember asking my brother to buy me a drink. You know, I understand that. So I came back home. When I left there, I had to pull my car over because I just cried. I was powerless. I could not help him. Every time I would talk at a meeting, I would share about my son. And people in AA would say to me, "I will pray for Demetrius." And I believe in the power of prayer. I do believe that's the only reason I'm standing here right now. You know, and people did pray for my son. My son now is about 2 years sober. He's secretary of a meeting, and he's sponsoring guys. And he called me, and we talk Alcoholics Anonymous. He started asking me for advice. I told him to call his sponsor. I love my son. I have a daughter. My daughter has blessed me with two little girls, beautiful little girls. I'm a grandpa. My little granddaughters call me Papa, you know. When they want me to take them someplace or they want something, they call me Poppy, you know. I know when that's coming, you know. I love them. I love those girls so much. They just, out of the clear blue, they call me and say, Papa, what are you doing? Just the other morning, they have to go to school very early. So they get up around 6. One of them called me at 6:15, and I answered the phone and say, Papa, were you sleeping? I said, yeah, baby, but you can call Poppy anytime you want. You know, the other day we were out playing a little hopscotch together, me and my two granddaughters. Lots of fun. Play a little I won, too. You know, I absolutely love AA. I'll tell you, to sum it up, if you don't already know what my drinking was like, I'll tell you this little story about two little boys who used to live next door to me. One was 7 years old and one was 5 years old. So a little 7-year-old kid says to his 5-year-old brother, he goes, you know, I think we're old enough to start cussing. Little 5-year-old says, okay. So the 7-year-old says, I'm going to say hell, and you use the word fat ass. Little 5-year-old goes, okay. So the next morning, they go down for breakfast, and the mother comes. She looks at the 7-year-old, and she goes, so what would you like for breakfast this morning? He thinks. He says, and he thinks. He goes, oh, hell, just give me some Cheerios. She looks at him, she goes, what? And she's not happy with this. So she grabs, she gets the belt, she tears him up, you know, she throws him in the room. She slams the door behind him. And she looks at the 5-year-old and she says, now, what would you like for breakfast? He says, I don't know either, but you can bet your fat ass I don't want no Cheerios. So I'm drinking, I had no idea. So that was the deal. But I tell you what, if you're new, please keep coming back. Get a sponsor. This program works, and it works very, very well. I have a good life today, but I didn't get that good life by myself. You see, I can't do this thing by myself. I got this good life because of people like you. I've had people willing to spend time with me, and that is why I am willing to spend time with newcomers or any sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went on a great panel today with a bunch of great guys right from this group, and every single one of those guys offered these guys in a detox that you can call me. I will give you my phone number. You see, you can't keep it unless you give it away. I am so blessed that I ran across a group of people like you. You see, Robert can walk into these rooms and be who he is. You see, I would much rather be in these rooms telling you that I'm crazy than to be out there trying to convince them that I'm not. You know, you have taught me how to walk out of this room and conduct myself as a gentleman, as a citizen, and try to do the right thing. I am not perfect. I am not perfect, but you don't tell me I have to be perfect. But you have taught me, you've given me tools to work with. I have a great life, and it's all because of you. Thank you so very much for having me.